His wife's disturbed moaning dragged Jez Cord away from packing his kit, and he smiled sympathetically. Anna had been asleep for several hours, and while he knew she would never admit it, her nerves were jangled before going out on the mission. They were in the married quarters of a gulag that was once part of Stalin's death camp infrastructure. He'd been at the camp for 3 months, although he hadn't been aware of the first two. He'd spent them in a coma as a result of his previous task, and up to that point had been known as Jez Kornfeld. Fit enough now to tag along with Anna on her Turkish mission, he was sure, but General Mikhail Petrochova had other ideas. "It's too soon," he told him. "You would be detrimental to the operation. Go out into the cold long enough to prove yourself robust. Return in good shape, and I will consider re-establishing you as an active agent." To the north of the goldfield surrounding Johannesburg sat the richest square mile in all of Africa, Sandton. Formerly a suburb of Joburg, Sandton successfully divorced itself from the Golden City and became a municipality in its own right. Now free of spreading urban blight, the affluent white community of Sandton safely prospered in its exclusive, posh enclave. The color of the driver's skin disqualified him from living in Sandton, even in the unlikely event he could afford it. The place he called home was bleak and dangerous. It was a bastard, an unloved city within a city. Institutionally named Southwestern Townships, better known as Soweto, this long-ostracized black suburb of Johannesburg was a soulless ghetto. Row upon row of decaying shacks inhabited the featureless landscape. Carcasses of spent tires, broken glass bottles, rusted oil cans, and dank corrugated cardboard boxes littered the uneven roads and unkempt alleys. When Jeremy walked out onto the stage at Frick Hall, he felt a momentary sense of displacement. Out of habit, he expected to find chairs, music stands, and a podium. Instead, he found an empty stage and about 180 people in the audience. "Aha," he thought. "The musicians seem to have come en masse." Mrs. Billings walked over to him on stage.
"Mr. Hendrick is here, but he is not feeling quite well. He asked me if I would introduce you."
She hesitated.
"I don't quite know how."
"When in America," he said, and offered her a kindly smile, "why not allow me to introduce myself, and you can stay out of the line of fire."
He walked over to the edge of the stage and sat, dangling his long legs over the side. He waited for everyone to stop talking.
"Good. Can everyone hear me?"
The question was met by mumbled murmurings.
"If at any time you can't hear me, wave your hand. If you do not like what I'm saying, you may feel free to hurl tomatoes."
He gazed upon a sea of expressionless faces and shrugged his shoulders.
"Pity. A lost opportunity."
The SS officer approached Steinberg, apprising him.
"You are Professor Eli Steinberg. What right do you have breaking into my home like this?"
The officer smirked in amusement and turned to his soldiers.
"Perhaps we should have arranged for an appointment. How rude of us."
Two soldiers gripped Steinberg by the arms and slammed him into his desk chair. The SS officer eyed the articles on his desk, then leaned over, studying him.
"I'm told you are a man of vision, Professor. Vision is an admirable quality," he toyed. "It's also dangerous."
He motioned for his soldiers to search the house. They exploded into action, rifling through bookshelves and treasured possessions in the Steinberg home. The officer leaned closely to Steinberg, noting every nuance in his face.
"So, it's time for the creation of a state of Israel, you say? A country of their own now? In which century will that take place, Professor?"
"The sail holds the wind well enough, in spite of the numerous holes and tears that cover its surface. Tosh just stands at the rudder, day and night. His mumbling has gotten clearer, but he still stares at us like we're hiding food under our clothes. He still won't speak of Salazar, no matter how we ask. He did tell us a story I'd never heard before. The Blight Sea, he said, during one of his more lucid moments, had not always been so large, nor had it always been devoid of life.
"Once," he said, "there was a tribe that lived near the centre of where this sea now sits, a poor tribe dying of thirst in the grasslands that once bordered the Nanten and rested between the two great mountain ranges. Well, they prayed and they prayed, and as things got desperate, Inferi heard their pleas."
Inferi is the name of the local water goddess, he told us. Some variation on the dread gods of old, but one that he claimed is very much alive today. Perhaps the greatest challenge in undertaking an expedition is, what do we do when things don't work according to the plan? What do we do when disaster strikes? Not every disaster can be predicted or averted. The more successful Antarctic expeditions were those with the greatest redundancy in supply, transport, and time allowance to address emergencies as they arose. Even the most astute advanced planning had to have a backup plan, and the best had a backup plan for the backup. Every polar expedition ran into situations that were not accounted for in the preliminary planning. Adversities of weather proved to be greater than could have been imagined. The sea ice in a given year did not behave as it had done in the past, and ships were prevented from reaching shore to pick up stranded parties or offload crucial supplies. Unseen crevasses suddenly opened and swallowed dogs, sledges, and men, leaving those who survived with no easy means to trek to safety. Sudden frostbite, accident, and injury, and the slow debilitation of scurvy weakened the once hardy men who had so bravely set out on their journey. That so many survived, even with these disasters, is a tribute to the character of the men who journeyed alongside or risked all to come in rescue.